antique dealer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm also a member of the Legislative Committee of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, Oregon Auto Dealers Association, whom I'm here representing today. The fact that these two bills are being heard at the same time, I would like to indicate to you that the great majority of the dealers of Oregon oppose House Bill 2084. And the attitude of them toward 2083 is that if we are going to have a bill, it could be livable with a few minor adjustments or amendments to the bill. But right now I'm going to address myself to House Bill 2084. The objectives of the bill are very vague, and if we interpret them properly, they are completely unattainable. The first thing we have to realize is the most costly service experience a franchise dealer or independent garage can have is to hire an unqualified mechanic. Servicing of cars today is a specialized field, such as that of doctors. With the sophisticated equipment on modern-day automobiles, it is a very rare and sought-after man that would be qualified for a license to work on all areas of service. Our own mechanics, who have on the average of 17 years' experience, recently took the examinations offered by the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, which is sponsored by NADA. It's a nonprofit organization, testing organization in Washington, D.C. And these examinations cover four areas. Number one, engines, fuel induction, ignition, and exhaust systems. Number two, gear train, which is your automatic transmission, manual transmissions, drive lines, and axles. Number three, steering, suspension, wheels, and brakes. And number four, starting and charging systems, electrical, body and chassis, and basic air conditioning. Now these people, with the number of years experience that they've had, who could only pass two of these areas, actually they only took two, and it would take additional training for these other areas, but as I mentioned before, it's almost impossible to have one mechanic qualify for all of these areas. If the state licensed men and or women in the basics of each of these areas, it would in no way ensure the public of the individual's ability to perform inexpensive and complaint-free work. Franchise dealers have constant pressure from their factories for improvement. One of our biggest customers is the factory. Between approximately 20 to 50% of the total retail labor sales is paid for by the manufacturer. And certainly they're not going to sit by and watch us have incompetent help. Constant training is offered and insisted upon by the manufacturers. General Motors has a sophisticated training center out in Tigard, as does Ford and Chrysler and VW in their respective zone offices. There are mobile units that American Motors, Toyota, and other foreign cars have that travel throughout the Northwest and visit dealerships and offer courses in these various service areas. We have in our organization a group called AutoCAP, which is the Auto Consumer Action Panel, which was inaugurated in 1973, the fall of 73. We spent several thousand dollars advertising on the radio, inviting complaints from people who were having trouble communicating with the dealers regarding service in other areas. We had a total of 752 complaints last year, and that was not only through our advertising, but were also referred to us from the Oregon Consumer League, the district attorney's offices around the state, and Consumer Protection Commissioner, whatever they call it, and also the Better Business Bureau. I've yet to see any of these complaints that would have been eliminated by a mechanic's licensing. Some of them might have been altered somewhat if we had House Bill 2083, because there were several complaints involving discrepancies in what the customer was told was going to cost resulting cost to him. Most of these were through misunderstanding and expecting too much gas mileage not being familiar with the decrease in performance of the more recent models which have the emission controls. There's much more to customer satisfaction other than the knowledge of the mechanics. The mechanics' attitude and ability to perform and experience cannot be measured by any written examination. Government control of mechanics would only tend to increase the number of complaints because of the public's tendency to have confidence in anything that is sponsored by a public agency. In other words, any person who passed this basic test for licensing, the person he worked for could hang his shingle out and say, we have Oregon licensed mechanics. Good service shops would actually lose their incentive to do a better job because of the fact that everybody is put in the same category. I personally don't like the provision in Section 27 of House Bill 2084, which provides for a complete record of all licensed mechanics with names and addresses to be sold to anyone on request. After spending years of time and hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars training expert mechanics for the people in the state of Oregon, dealers in Washington and California, where retail labor rates run as high as $25 an hour, would lure all of our good mechanics out of the area and we would wind up with the leftovers. So basically, if House Bill 2084 were to pass, I think it would be a very unjust thing to the 95% of the dedicated and qualified mechanics in the state of Oregon. Now, we have recently had a survey just taken within the last two or three weeks, which of our over 400 members, we received 142 back, which in that short length of time was pretty good, indicating that in 1974, of those 142, 792,502 repair orders were written. If I understand correctly from what I read in the paper, that through the various public agencies that handle complaints in the state, they receive about 300 a month, which would indicate that in this ratio, over 2 million repair orders are written a year, but the number of complaints are less than 0.3%. So I think that what we're trying to correct is not going to happen through legislation of this type. As far as House Bill 2083 is concerned, if this is to become law, I'd like to refer to page 10, where you're talking about the board to be set up, and I don't believe that there should be three motor vehicle mechanics on a board of nine to settle independent garage or dealer servicing problems. I think this is a problem of management. They should be involved. One mechanic, I would think, would be reasonable enough that might be qualified to answer technical questions, and you already have a service manager on there. So if this becomes a law, I would like to recommend that you either replace a couple of the mechanics with outside people or reduce the size of the committee. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. If there are any questions,
you have a copy of your testimony with the clerk.
I just got back in town. I just wrote it out last night, but I can have it typed out, get it to you by tomorrow.
You don't have to have it by tomorrow.
I have brought with me the examination books, which show you what the mechanics do to qualify for the under this National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence.
Representative Kraft?
Yes, Mr. Winter. On 2083 here, we're referring to Section 28. On page 9, last line, of the nine members, two shall be selected from the public at large, and they shall not, going over to page 10, have a substantial economic interest in the motor vehicle sale or repair industry. I think you said something to the effect that there should be some people from the public at large.
Well, I think they would, if it was loaded with just industry-oriented people, they'd think the committee was loaded against the public. I think to have people from the outside is...
I couldn't agree with you more on that. I think that's what you tend to do with all of the planning boards.
But I think you have too many mechanics. I wouldn't want to let my mechanic go and spend all day down here. There's no way you could reimburse him. It's just going to cost the industry his full wages or what he's missing to appear before committee.
I think these boards are paid per diem, I believe.
If you can. Depends on the board.
We don't have an employee that wouldn't quit if you had a year per diem.
On this particular item, Section 28, subsection 2, A, two shall be selected from the public at large, and they shall not have, what would you think of striking the word substantial?
That would be all right. I don't see what purpose that would serve. I think you're going to have two people who are not connected in any way with a service agency.
That's, I think, what the line would say if that word was...
Well, I see what you mean. Who do not have any economic interest. I think that was probably the intention of that section of the board, is to have two people in an unrelated industry represented on the board.
Come same day, Mr. Chairman. Mary just throws this out to everyone. Sitting there talking to licensing mechanics, and the mechanics I've talked to, they don't see anything wrong in licensing their field. And are we going to have any mechanics today? I just kind of wanted to ask that question.
Yep.
We are? Okay.
Well, I don't think, I mean, you could license pedestrians. I don't think anybody would object to it. But the thing I'm getting at is, what is it going to accomplish? Licensing a mechanic, or maybe he could say, I'm a licensed mechanic, I can fix anything, isn't going to solve the problem. As was mentioned by the previous gentleman who testified, you already have a grandfather clause in there, so that until you have complete turnover mechanics, you're not going to have any idea in the world whether it's going to correct it, because everybody that's in business now is going to be licensed. It's been in business for over, any mechanic's been in over 4 years. And I think the majority of them have, by the great majority. So you're not going to eliminate customer complaints. And if 0.3% of the work done is complained about, I don't know of any industry in the world that has fewer complaints than that. Your complaints have to be related to volume, and certainly there are some areas where they have fewer transactions that the complaints don't seem as great, but are 10 times as great.
Keep going until you finish.
Okay. Wouldn't you agree, though, that the mechanics themselves, if they think a licensing procedure would help their industry, they're more closely related to it, just like the American Medical Association, they examine their own people, because doctors know what's best for doctors, you know. So why can't the mechanics have that same kind of input, it seems like, to me?
Well, we're, in effect, examining our own people through this National Institute for Automotive Excellence.
Just that you're referring to AutoCAD?
No, no. No, I'm talking about this test that's given out of Washington. It's an independent organization, non-profit, and these booklets you'll be able to read, and the dealer has not. He doesn't have to do it, but they want to do it, and the idea of it is to improve the image of the mechanics in the eyes of the public. Now, there isn't a single one of our men, 7 out of our 8 mechanics have taken it and passed in different areas, but they're no better mechanic now than they were before they took it. All they did is they can hang up the shingle, so when a customer comes in and sees it, say he is a qualified mechanic, and he is, but he makes mistakes like you and I make. And some of them are real stupid. I admit, I make bad mistakes, and I'm sorry for them later, but I still feel that I'm qualified in the business I'm in, and I've been in it for 40 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Morrow.
We've had testimony from several witnesses today describing the process and the problems involved in the testing procedures. You have mentioned a testing procedure by a national institute of some sort. Can you be a little descriptive as to the kind of a test that they administer? Can you give us some evaluation as to your judgment as to the validity of this test?
Well, we have had dealers, that's why we don't have 100% cooperation, that have objected to it for the same reasons that have been mentioned here previously today. They are not all-inclusive. They don't actually show a mechanic's ability to fix or his attitude toward his work. All it shows is that he knows he can identify tolerances, he can identify ring gears and pinions or whatever it might be in this particular area of interest. But it does not change his attitude or his ability when he gets back to work. And I told you the primary interest of, or primary purpose of this was to improve the image in the eyes of the public. But it doesn't make him any better mechanic. We're not interested in having people who are not qualified. It did prove to me that our people do know what they're talking about, and some of them don't perform as well as others, but this takes time to train a good mechanic.
Well, is it part practical application, part of it written?
It's all written.
Entirely written,
then. Entirely written.
Just thinking out loud, I wonder what, for example, the U.S. Army does in their testing program for their mechanics. They're dealing with a whole spectrum of educational levels. They obviously must have some kind of system that they can use to determine.
Well, they have aptitude tests. I don't know whether you were in the Army or not, but that's the first thing you take, an aptitude test to find out what you're qualified to do. And I was qualified to be a guard, so I got put in the infantry. But I could do other things, but that my aptitude test indicated this is what I have in security and these areas, so that's what I wound up being. So they're not the final answer, certainly. As I mentioned before, I think anybody that's in business and wants to stay there, he's concerned about the reputation of the name of his concern, and he's going to do the best he can to get good qualified mechanics, and if he doesn't get them, he's going to see their training. We participate in the apprenticeship program and so forth, and keep a backlog of people who are ready to go to work and learn how to work the way we want.
If I may, one more question. The gentleman, Mr. Walker, made a point that he thought the U.S. was happy with 2084, but he thought 2083 might be beefed up some by requiring electric in the service managers, not the mechanics, in the service managers, and maybe include that in 2084. What's your reaction?
Well, I think 2083 includes the licensing of the service manager, doesn't it? It does not. Well, the way I've always felt about that, the same way as our new car dealer, bond, and everything else, the management of the company is responsible for the people he hires and has to answer for their activities. And if the dealer's licensees he's going to be responsible for the performance of his people, I'm sure that he's going to see that his service manager is qualified, but for the same reason that he's going to hire qualified mechanics.
You feel there's no need then to let service
managers? I don't. As I said before, the only thing in the bill that I think has merit would have to be flexible to a certain extent would be the fact that the customer be given an estimate with variation. Now you say, well, should it be written or should it be oral? There is a provision back in, let's see, on the next page, page 5, section 12, says to obtain consent if the customer, nothing in this section shall be construed as requiring a service dealer to obtain consent if the customer in writing specifically waives the right of a written estimate. And I would say that if this law were passed, probably 85 to 90% of our regular customers would sign that because they don't want to monkey around while you make that estimate. Because a lot of times, it'd be just like going to the doctor, say, I don't feel well, how much is it going to cost me? A guy's car is sick, he takes it in, and he might have to stand there for a couple hours while they scope the engine and so forth before they can give an actual written estimate. We do have written estimates in body work, and we could do it. As I say, it's a workable bill if you have to have a bill, but I don't think it's going to correct anything unless it's that particular area where maybe $100, work over $100, it could be in writing.
The problem is, Mr. Wentworth, I think that maybe you'll agree that it is the problems that we have with dealerships, such maybe as yours or the reputable dealers. Don't you agree the problem is with those that maybe rip off somebody now and then, and it's true, it happens. I think we've got written testimony here that it's happened.
Well,
that we're aiming at maybe a minority,
that minority that you're going to license is going to rip the people off for the next 100 years, whether they're licensed or not. If they're in business, they have to apply annually for a business license. And then, like the Attorney General pointed out, you have laws on the books right now that'll put them out of business every year.
Okay, and what happens then if that particular licensed service shop is found guilty of one of these rip-offs, and then his license is jerked, then what does he tell the public?
Well,
don't you agree that it's a little bit late once somebody has been ripped off to say, you learned the hard way, now don't go back? Isn't it too late then?
Well, which area are you referring to, the Attorney General's attitude or this law?
This law, your attitude.
Well,
rather than
as I say, whether you have this law or not, the guy that's ripping off the public, there are laws in the books which will put him out of business. All they have to do is refuse to renew his business license, just like the Oregon Liquor Commission. If they got a guy that's abusing the laws, they don't renew his license. And they can do the same thing in the business license area. They don't renew his business license.
They don't renew.
And he's out of business.
But we're talking about a license for a specific thing now, not just a general business license. We're talking about being licensed to serve a shop. I'm not talking about 2084. I'm talking about 2083 now. And once their license is pulled, isn't this a flag to the public that okay, you can stay away from this joker until he learns to straighten up and fly right?
Well, if his license is pulled, he closes up. There certainly be a flag. But the same thing would be true with the authority that they have now. They can close up any business they wanted.
That's quite a different step, though, isn't it, than just jerking in a license that was under this act?
Well, I think in either area, the license could be renewed if the guy signed a cease and desist order and so forth, and he'd be back in business in a couple months, in either area. So I can't see that this is a cure-all. It's inconceivable that either bill is going to solve all the problems.
I agree with you, probably will not, but it is a tool. Or is it just that?
Well, as I say, there are a couple areas that I think are good. I don't think they'll get the guy that is bent on chipping the public out of business. He's going to qualify, and he's going to lie his way out of it, and is still going to exist, and that's why the majority of service garages try to do a better job, so they get more business by word of mouth. And the guy that's continually jipping the public, they catch up with him. The public does.
But only after you jip the public.
Well, yeah, that's what we're talking about here.
That's the point I'd like to make, that's when we catch up with them, after they jip the public.
How is this bill going to let you catch him before he jips the public?
I don't know that it will precisely, but I think I feel myself, and I don't want to argue the bill. I think it'll go a long way short.
Drew?
You know, my reason for leaning towards licensing mechanics, I guess you say, is you have a mechanic. There's a high turnover in mechanics, usually, especially in places like Firestone and Goodyear and the gas station, maybe one of the gas stations. For some reason, it seems like every 2 months you go back to the station and there's a new mechanic there. And you go to the box and you say, what happened to Joe Blow? And he says, well, Joe blew because he wasn't a very competent mechanic. However, Joe's gone down the street, 5-10 blocks and been hired at another service center. And I've worked in the service station business for about 3 years when I was a little younger. And I found in gas stations and service centers, they don't check references. You know, you come and you say you're a mechanic, and you go, good, how long you been in the business? 5 years. And they go, fine. And they hire you right on the spot, usually. Mechanics are in demand. And they don't check a reference. They don't call the last place you work to see if the guy's incompetent. So it seems to me, an incompetent mechanic could go from station to station to station throughout his whole life and just keep getting a job and work someplace for a year until the boss finally decided that this guy just is incompetent and I have to get rid of him. But in the meantime, this guy is ripping off the public and it's causing the consumer, it's causing him time while he has to take his car back and get the problem corrected that was the fault of the mechanic in the first place. And you know, your time is important, and so is mine. I hate to have to take my car back to get it worked on again. If I take it in one day and spend all that time taking it in, then I have to take it in a week later because it wasn't done properly. And this is really what I'm after. That's the benefit I see in licensing the mechanic, is to keep that guy from hopping from shop to shop, because if he's incompetent in one place, we can yank his license, and he can't go down the street and get a job because he's not going to have a license.
Well, you're talking about an area that is, on the most part, not covered by this bill, and that's the guy that works in the service station. Unless the service station does brake work or front-end work, he's not required to be licensed. There's no way a good mechanic can make money in a service station unless it's a large garage-type station, but just a regular service station where he spends half his time lubricating and changing oil, which doesn't qualify in this, but a qualified, skilled mechanic cannot make what he should in the service station.
Well, I think
so he's not going to be there too long.
I think you'll find that changing now with the number of stations that are left. Like, we closed a lot of them up. My brother owns a service station, so I know quite a bit about the field. And they do make a lot of profit now. My brother makes $3,000 a month profit off his gas station. The mechanic makes $1,000 a month. So I'll have to disagree with your statement.
Does he have one qualified mechanic?
Well, as far as he knows, he's qualified. He hasn't got a license. But I talked to his mechanic, and his mechanic would just as soon be licensed because he feels, heck, I'm confident I can pass the test, you know, whether it's written or oral or whatever. This person might be a little more intelligent than others.
Well, that might be true, but the only thing, as I indicated before, is if there are people who can take the test that are not going to be competent mechanics, they'll pass and get a license.
That's true in any field now, though.
And that's what I say. I don't think it'll correct that area.
I think it will somewhat. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I think we will have about a 10-minute break. People seem to be squirming quite a bit. Sorry about that. We have a forum. What we lost them. Oh, there's Drew over there. There's Drew over there. That's enough. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's enough. Well, I find the sheets now. Oh, Drew over there. And just for the committee's information, we have 11 more witnesses to be heard. I'm not saying don't ask questions, but I'm saying hold them short. And Dewey Harvest.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Dewey Harless, and I own an independent repair shop in the city of Portland. We employ 18 people. We have a general repair shop, which I refer to as a mechanical repair shop. We have a body and fender shop, and a frame shop, and a paint shop, and a machine shop. I come to you with no formal presentation. I only come to you as a citizen and a man of business who has been in that business in that same location for 22 years. And I, like Chuck Wentworth, who is right across the street from me, have had my share of problems in this business. I've been in Mr. Johnson's office twice, taken there by customers, once found guilty and once found innocent. That's a 500 batting average. For a great deal of my life in this business, I have felt that we ought to have some bonding and some licensing of service managers, auto repair shops, and mechanics. The deeper we get into it, the more, I think the word I need is ambivalent about the whole thing. House Bill 2083, since we're dealing with both of them, I find that I could live with quite easily. As far as giving estimates, for one thing, I from listening to the testimony thus far, it seems to me that that is one of the big, heavy areas that we are wanting to get straightened out. That would be, to me, absolutely no problem. It seems to me that I spend part of my 10-hour day, maybe like 30% of it, on the phone discussing problems with people, trying to satisfy them, trying to tell them what's the matter with their vehicle. in my shop. If you come into the shop, unfortunately, you have to deal with me. I do think in House Bill 2083 that the bond for $2,500 is certainly inadequate. If I make a mistake or one of my mechanics makes a mistake, as for example, leaving a conrod bolt loose and destroying an engine, at today's inflated prices for labor and for parts and material, I don't think $2,500 would even come anywhere near it. As I read the bill, you could then, anything over $2,500 go to the owner or the shop manager, whoever's in charge, and collect from him, as it were. I, for one, would like to see this industry upgraded. I am really sick and tired of having the public refer to the automobile mechanic as the grease monkey. It's a respected profession. I don't tell many people this. I am a college graduate. When I got out of college, I wanted to be in the garage business. I've been happy there ever since, in spite of the troubles with the consumer. I don't really feel that the consumer ought to be wrapped in a cocoon of protection, much like I don't want to see legislation become so heavy that the cost thing gets so overwhelming, and clerical work, administrative work, and listening to all these complaints from what I choose to call the 5% malcontent who comes crawling out and is continually unhappy no matter what it is you do with his automobile. We have hired and trained countless numbers of employees, and when they reach the so-called journeyman level, I find that they all would like to go out and try it for themselves. And I condone this. I think it's a good training ground for a man to be at an independent repair shop. I think he learns a lot of things there. I do not think that we can legislate morality. I keep hearing the word ripoff. There are those people. If the man is going to rip you off, it doesn't matter, I think, whether you wear coveralls, whether you wear a suit and tie, whether you drive a Volkswagen, or whether you drive a Rolls Royce. If he wants you and you're available, he's going to get it. I think the customer has his own moral right to choose his mechanic, much like he would choose his attorney or his doctor or his stockbroker, and then consequently deal with him. And if a problem arises, don't hit each other with sticks, but work it out like civilized human beings. What I am saying now is that the more I hear of the testimony and the deeper I read into the bills, I'm not too sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think these days and these times, with money dollars like they are, that we do not want to have to pass on to the customer a great giant addition to his hourly rate or the price of his parts or however one wants to do it in order to pay for legislation to protect that customer. Thank you very much. Is there any questions?
Any questions?
Mr. Harless.
Sir?
Harless.
Harless.
Harless?
Harless. H-A-R-L-E-S-S.
All right.
Sorry.
You mentioned them passing the cost on to the consumer. Do you have any your own perceptions of what that might be?
No, sir, I don't. And I don't think anybody else that will come up here and testify in front of you can possibly have that, because the bill is yet not in effect. The bill does not say that the price for licensing or bonding or examination will remain the same. That, I think, is the minor thing. I don't think really that it's going to get passed on to the customer as he comes in to get his automobile repaired. I think what will happen is that the giant number of complaints, if they turn out to be as large as they are in California, for example, or New Jersey, will have to be handled by a great number of salaried state employees, as I see it, the way the bill is written. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I interpret it. This board, of nine members that will meet six times a year. If, for example, I think the bill says they do not have to handle those customer complaints, but if a board does have to handle those customer complaints and they're not in Lee Johnson's office, for example, I think they, if they had six meetings per year, each one of them would last 2 months. And they would be busy all the year, and they would never get back to their jobs. That is where I think the expense will come, and then the taxpayer will somehow end up paying that. That's my opinion.
The cost that would take to do these pages?
Yes, sir. That's where I think the cost will come. The clerical administrative work.
And then I...
That's what frightens me.
I'm not that familiar with the California law. What is this the case then that when the California law was enacted that cases of consumer complaints started rising?
Yes.
And
yes,
do you
that's
just
true.
Attribute that to maybe unneeded or unwarranted complaints, or to the fact that there was some place for them that they felt they could really go?
Your last part of your question is your answer, because they all of a sudden had a place to go. You asked Mr. Johnson if the public knows where to go in case they have a problem as a consumer. I have appeared on two or three television shows in Portland, and one of the things I always give is that phone number. I have it in my shop. People ask me for it. I think it should be made available to them. And if this bill becomes law, it will take an educational process to get the public to understand this law and let them know where they can go.
Are you well acquainted with the California law?
I am not as well acquainted with the California law as I am this one. I do know this, but when the California law was first put into effect, I was in a training school in San Francisco, and they had 33 mechanics, and 32 of them failed. That I was there to see. But a great deal like the bar examination, you can go and get yourself straightened out and go and take the written test again and again and again until you do finally pass it.
Basically, you agree that good mechanics, qualified mechanics, should not pass the test.
I beg your pardon. I don't quite understand your question.
Qualified, good mechanics could possibly fail a written test.
Absolutely. I've only seen, so far, you have no test. Am I correct?
No.
A test has not been formulated. I have seen one test that has been formulated. And I really don't think that any journeyman mechanic in my shop, which is a shop that works on anything that's on wheels, I mean, we're not relegated just to working on Cadillacs or Oldsmobiles or Volkswagen, whatever it is. I don't think there's a man in my shop that could pass that test. Let's take, for example, a body and fender man who was repairing a front-end collision on a Buick with air conditioning and a collapsible steering column, and the impact wheels and the side of the door. You ask the average body man, all right, fine, there's the collapsible steering gear. Do you suppose that when you get all done with this car, you can install that steering gear and align the front end of this car? I don't think you can do that. Now, that's a manual test. How can you... ask a man a written question on a piece of work like that. He can give you the figures in degrees for negative or positive camber, but can he do it?
May have something.
Thank you.
Representative Davis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your opening testimony, you referred to the cost of hourly rate for automobile repairs, mechanic licensing bill passed. Why would you think the hourly rate would increase?
I really don't think I inferred that. If I did, I didn't mean to infer that. And I think I answered that question to the gentleman on your right, that a $50 license fee or a $25 licensing fee is certainly not going to hurt my shop. It's not going to make me go out and say my labor rate was $15 an hour. It's now going to be $17.50. That's foolish. I did not mean to infer that. I apologize if I did.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was referring to the other bill, 2084, licensing mechanics. We got the two together here, and we get mixed up a lot.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Do you think by licensing the mechanic that hourly rate for a mechanic is going to increase by any substantial amount? And if so, why?
Well, at this point, I really don't think it would increase the hourly rate. I don't see how it could. I've heard it said, well, then the shop must pay for the licensing fee for the mechanic. I've heard that argument, and that would have to be passed on. That's really not necessarily so. The mechanic has to be, according to this bill, relicensed each year. And the amount, I think, is more than fair. I think it's a minimal amount. I think it's just something for bookkeeping. It cannot possibly pay the bills, believe me. I think you must realize that. I don't know what the number of mechanics are in the state of Oregon, but if you take $25 a piece from them, you're not going to have enough to perpetrate this bill. You're not going to have enough to administer it. That's certainly not going to pay the bill. I don't think, anyway. I hope I've answered your question.
Representative Moore?
You've been before the AG and you've established the track record and you've commented about the problems with testing and have other witnesses. Could we accomplish the same thing for the consumer and at reduced cost by beefing up the AG and in essence putting his name and phone number on the garage doors across the state of Oregon?
Well, I'll answer you the best way I know how. In both instances that I was in the office in Salem on a consumer complaint, I feel that we were treated very fairly. Both of them were cleaned up, as it were, within 2 weeks. Both customers went away satisfied. As a matter of fact, one of them is still a customer in my shop. I think it's possible. I know that in traveling through California, if you stop in a service station, if you stop in a garage, you will see a poster 3 feet by 2 feet with all that information and the law stated and a toll-free telephone number. Might very well work just as well.
Thank you. Anything further?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bernard Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, my name is Bernard Jensen. I've been a mechanic for the past 24 years, 12 in the last place that worked for Mr. Harless, and I'm definitely for the bill. There's certain things about it that would have to be changed, but it may help upgrade our image a little bit, which, you know, we've kind of taken a beating from the press and newspapers and magazines, and they seem to ball it all together that if a guy's got a pair of pliers and a screwdriver, well, he's automatically a mechanic, which isn't the case anymore. That's my position.
You're in favor of licensing both shops and mechanics.
Yes, I am.
If we work out a good
yes.
program.
Yes. Uh-huh. Mr. Jensen, you say you are a mechanic?
Yes.
Yeah. How long have you been a mechanic?
24 years.
Are you opposed to being licensed?
No.
You put would upgrade your industry?
Yes.
Professionalize it?
Yes.
Such as electrician?
Yes.
Take more pride in your work if you were licensed, do you think?
I wouldn't, but I take a lot of pride in the work as it is now. I'm trying to keep up on things. But, I'm hoping it would help the industry.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jensen, do you work for one of the major shops, automobile agencies, or
independent shop?
You work for an independent
yes,
shop?
Yes, I do.
And it is not your shop?
No, it isn't.
Anything further? Thank you. Carl Manns, I guess this is.
automobile mechanic since 1960. I am definitely for licensing. However, I think this bill needs some work. I feel that it should cover all phases of repair, including service aid. I have a very good, for instance, of a friend of mine that had her car worked on the station, supposedly tuned up, and they didn't take a compression test and had a cracked head. The owner of the station wasn't qualified to even wire the distributor cap, and his mechanics were two, probably 18-year-olds that were pumping gas. No protection for the public or the consumer or anybody for that matter. That's all I can tell you.
Representative Davis,
Chairman.
Commands. I think it's going to make a point of clarification here. It seems to be carrying down from an earlier witness that this doesn't include gas stations, and it does include gas stations if they do automobile repairs, such as a tune-up in the electrical system. It does exclude changing the oil, but there's nothing to change in oil except dropping a bolt,
correct,
and lubing the car with a gun up there and shooting. The types of things that are excluded from the bill are those things that my 5-year-old son can almost do. We're going to license everyone, if this bill passes, 2084. It would license everybody that does any type of mechanical work that is of a major nature. So it does include gas stations.
Anything
thank you.
Else?
Not if they do mechanical work.
Okay, I heard service stations. I started looking, so I didn't hear the rest of your statement.
I'm sorry. It's service stations, gas stations. Anybody, if you set up a shop in the back of your garage and do it for a profit motive, then you're going to have to be licensed.
You work as an independent for an independent.
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Greenleaf, wherever he's at, I don't see him. There he is. You were hiding back there.
My name is Marvin Greenling. I, at this time, am representing the Automotive Service Councils of Oregon for those members who could not be here, which will number approximately 90 in the three metropolitan areas, Portland, Eugene, and Salem. If we must have licensing, and I've testified to this previously, we will support House Bill 2083. We don't feel we want to support 2084. There are reasons. I've heard a lot of questions asked in regards to it. I can see problems in my own shop with 2084 going through as a bill. Most of us at present time, if we're operating a legitimate business, are operating under 23 anyway. There are sections of the thing I feel should be changed, because in Section 3, for instance, it states in the bill that it shall be unlawful to engage in business as a service dealer unless he has a license in accordance with Section 4. But it does not state that he cannot repair someone else's car for a fee or a price. Now, this at one time was written into one of these bills during the last session, I'm sure, that if he was repairing an automobile for a consumer for fee or price, that he had to have a dealer's license. But that hasn't been incorporated into this bill. So consequently, what we're saying here, if you decide House Bill 2083 is to become a bill or a law, that you want to license me, but an individual working, we'll use the word moonlighting if you want, can do any kind of work that he wants on the side, and there are people who do this that are working in other types of professions, but he isn't required to have a license. And the work that he is putting out could definitely be in conflict with Section 2, which states the general purpose of this bill. In Section 9, we feel that the board should have more authority than they presently do. It has already come up time and time again, so I'm not going to try to take too much time here. But it has come up in previous testimony that they feel the director has too much power. I feel that if you're going to have a board, operating board such as this, that the director should be required to take recommendations from this board. And the way the bill is presently written, he doesn't have to. Likely as not, he will, but he doesn't have to. In sections 11 and 12, we're constantly asking questions as to the cost if the bill goes through to the consumer. It's been testified time and time again that it shouldn't, mostly, by people who are not operating the businesses, that it should not increase the cost considerably to the consumer. My type of business, it definitely will, because I work mostly on import line. And I have problems all day long trying to locate parts, let alone tell a customer how much that part's going to cost when I don't know whether I've got to go to Chicago to get it, or San Francisco, for instance, or Portland, or whether I can get it here in town. But in sections 11 and 12, it will require two copies of a work order to be given to a customer, the way the bill is presently stated. One at the time that you write the work order and require his signature, two at the time that he picks up his automobile after the work's completed. Now, in my particular work orders, I have three copies plus the hard copy on them now. A lot of the shops are not using this. Now, if there is any insurance involved with this particular work or warranty work, this will require an additional copy of the work order, which is going to require a copying machine in this establishment. In Section 12, it really bothers me, because in writing this estimate, I know this is where the majority of our complaints are coming from, and I'm in favor of trying to eliminate the situation. I've spent enough time, and Wanda Merrill can testify to that I've sat down there in her office going over consumer complaints. I'm willing to donate my time for doing this if I feel that we can help resolve some of them and give the trade a better image and help some of the consumers. But the majority of our complaints, the way I see it, are coming from lack of communication between the shop owner, if it's a one-man shop, two-man shop, between the individual talking to the consumer and the consumer. He isn't handled properly to start with. So consequently, the complaint normally comes from an oral estimate that's given of $100, let's say, for a valve grind, and it turns out $400, and consumer isn't contacted. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I feel, personally, these are fraudulent practices. But if the estimate, let's say, is $100, if the estimate is given to a consumer of $100 and it comes out $120, I don't see why an individual should have to spend an hour out of a working day trying to contact a consumer to get authorization to finish the automobile. And this is where this written estimate, as we presently have it written, comes into play, which I feel definitely will have to be passed on to the consumer as an additional cost. There's got to be a way of helping the consumer at the same time making the thing workable as far as we are concerned in the repair business. At one of the interim hearings, it was suggested that a variance of 15%, we had asked for more than this, but the committee had agreed that 15% we would incorporate this into the bill on the written estimate for parts. But it was never incorporated into this bill. I nor no one else apparently ever I'll have to agree, I didn't, never volunteered to put it in writing, hand it in, so consequently the bill was rewritten, and that 15% variance on parts estimate wasn't put in it. But this would help at least somewhat as far as the cost of, if we did have a 15% variance in parts, it would help somewhat in the cost of making this estimate. You can call them today and get a price on a particular part. I don't care whether it's body work or what. And if that particular part is delivered tomorrow morning, there may be a price increase tonight, which is going to bring the part up another 15 to 20%. And this is the way these parts are jumping. It's ridiculous, but it's happening, and we haven't got any control. So consequently, if a person made an estimate for a customer, and let's say he needed an additional seal, gaskets, or on an engine overhaul, for instance, forgot to include an oil filter or oil, at least if we did have some variance, he wouldn't have to contact that customer, spend his time, and make it an inconvenience to the customer to finish the job if he couldn't be contacted. In section 13, I feel it should be added in there that the dealer should not be required to keep the replaced parts on a job that was done more than 5 to 7 days after the consumer was notified the work was completed. I've seen people in Alaska, for instance, where I do an overhaul for them on a particular car. They'll leave the car with me, and they'll be working in Alaska, and they may not pick up that car for 2 months. I'll have to build a warehouse and to help stock, keep some of these displaced parts, the ones that are too big, to hand back to the customer. If they're small parts, we, at the present time, and I think most of our association members do this, they're put in a sack and given back to the customer at the time the work's completed, put inside the car. But if in a case of an engine overhaul, lots of times you'll encounter some pieces that aren't practical to be able to be put in inside the car. So consequently, I don't feel we should be required to keep the parts more than 5 to 7 days after he's been contacted that the work's completed if he does not pick up his vehicle within that time. Section 24 and 25 again refers to the director of the power of the director, and I think there that recommendations should be given that the board would have more power than they presently do. We don't read the bill this at the present time that the board has enough power. Section 27 again does not specify a mechanic cannot moonlight on the side, which could be in conflict with section 2 if his work wasn't done properly. And it's already been brought up that if both bills were to be passed, it would require 2 licenses for a one-man operation, which definitely would, the way they're presently written. That plus the cost of a bond, plus the estimating bit, definitely would have to increase the cost to the consumer. At the present time, a service dealer is responsible for work performed by his employees, or he should be. If he's offering a legitimate business, he's definitely responsible for it. House Bill 2083 would give sufficient protection to the consumer, we feel, if it's properly written. And 2084 would only add to the bureaucratic expense at this time when inflation is already eroding the consumer's pocketbook. The questions were brought up a little earlier in regards to testing mechanics. For 2 years, I worked with Frank Ward from Salem here on NATCB testing mechanics. We went to Eugene, did this through the community colleges down there in Portland, and Salem here likewise. And then they disbanded NATCB and went to NICE, went to National Institute of Automotive Service Excellence when they formed this. No, the state of Oregon is not going to produce tests to test a mechanic, I don't feel, that would accomplish any more than what could be done through this NICE testing presently, unless they were to be given oral tests along with written tests. And in my case of my mechanics, for instance, if 2084 was to go through, I feel I have 3 men on the line that would feel that they all deserve the same amount of pay. I don't see it this way. If a man, I pay my men by the hour, but if I've got a man over here that's producing half again as much as one sitting next to him, I feel he should be paid accordingly. And I can't help but believe in my mind, I could be wrong about this, but I can't help but believe that if 2084 goes through, that the man that's producing more is going to be held back to the man who is working beside him, as long as they both have mechanics licenses as journeymen.
Mr. Greeny, I know you spend a lot of time with Juan, and I also know you spent during the interim a lot of time working on these bills in the committee to make it workable. And I kind of gathered by your remarks that you don't think this bill is what the committee had agreed on.
2083.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it is quite, Mr. Chairman. There's the majority of it is, yes. But I feel there's portions, I feel that there's portions of it that's been changed. I reread all of the bills that we had during the interim from front to back, and then I tried to compare them to the next one that came out. And I don't feel that 2083, once they were split up, was quite the way that the subcommittee that was appointed last session had rewrote it. However, there's nothing wrong with the bill. I feel we can live with it, and I think it will help the consumer, but I do think that we still need some changes to be made in.
I was just curious. I don't know how much, but I know you spent considerable of your own time on trying to make these things workable. And I'm just curious, because your one remark, perhaps you thought there was somebody trying to pull a cushion somewhere down the line.
Oh, no. Anytime you get
I didn't mean it.
Excuse me.
Exactly.
But anytime we get a reprint, there's bound to be changes come about. And I really think this is probably some of the things that's happened. You know.
Of course, I think you'd be commended anyway for the volunteer time you put in on this and what you wanted to do.
But I can't, excuse me, I can't sit here as a shop owner in town for years and years, working men, and believe there won't have to increase cost to the consumer with what we're going to have to do as the bill is presently written, but possibly this cost, what additional cost will have to be passed on to the consumer, possibly will outweigh the disadvantages of not having the bill. That I won't argue. This remains to be seen.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to apologize for making such a test of myself today.
All right, we'll accept it.
But I'm trying to get in my mind whether or not this is going to cost the consumer more. That's what we're getting at.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Why do you think you made the statement that if we weren't to this licensing and whatnot, these bills, your mechanics would have to be paid the same? Why did you say that? You stated that, I believe.
Yes. They would. My mechanics. I'm sure that in few cases the mechanics would prefer the 2084 licensing bill. Or they seem to have that attitude, and this is true to a certain extent. Our trade has not been paid sufficient amount of money. A mechanic working on the line is in poverty stage almost, has been previously. But if all my men in my shop, for instance, have a license saying they're journeyman mechanic, and I have two of them out of three that's been through the state apprenticeship program, then they're going to feel that they all should be receiving the same amount of pay per hour as journeyman. If I'm paying one man, let's say $5 an hour, the one that isn't producing only two-thirds as much will be satisfied with $4.80 an hour, like I say. He's going to feel that he should be getting $5 an hour likewise. And I may have wrong interpretation of this, but this I'm sure would be the feeling of the men in my shop.
Couldn't you let the mechanic go that wasn't producing?
Well, you can, except that we're too short of them right now.
Okay, one more quick question.
Sure.
You spoke to how a job costs different. It costs a different price. You do the same kind of work, like change the transmission on 65 Chevy and change the transmission on another 65 Chevy, and it might cost you a different price. Don't you have a book that you go by, something like flat rate or something like this, I believe, where they set out in booklets how much it should cost, how many hours it should take to do a certain job, and you charge accordingly out of the book?
We have books. The way they're written present time, they give you the factory flat rate for warranty work, and then they give you the recommended time it should take to do the job. But no two jobs, especially in my work, I find, in the kind of car we work on, no two jobs normally end up the same. You take, for instance, we'll take a Triumph or an MG, we'll say. Okay, you look up flat rate for pulling out the transmission in a Triumph. They don't figure in that flat rate manual, take in consideration that that car's had a radio in, because when that car was delivered from the factory, it didn't come with a radio in. But that car's got a radio in, let's say, and it will take a man an additional 45 minutes to remove and replace the radio if he doesn't tear it out of there and throw it back in. It'll take an additional 45 minutes, but this isn't incorporated in your flat rate. So this flat rate manual is only a suggested time, really. And in a few cases, I have seen some of them where they will put carpeting down, for instance, with nails, let's say. Well, by the time you take one of those apart and put it back together, and you have no way of knowing this when the car comes into you. So consequently, I feel that the written estimate that we'd be required to give, we can't live with it. Some of them have testified they could, but I don't feel I can live with it without having to contact the consumer many times, or else I'm going to have to ask 90% of my customers to sign the waiver. And I'm not too sure how this would look in the director's face if I had a complaint in this regard.
Thank you very much. President Rogers?
I have two questions. The first one probably calls for an opinion on your part. We had quite a bit of conversation about the cost to the consumer. You think that, in your opinion, would the restrictions as they are in these bills cause more removal and replacement of component parts instead of repair of the component?
I do. I myself, for instance, feel that I would have to give the estimate to the consumer of replacement of a master cylinder, which would run $70-$80, if I was giving him an estimate. I couldn't very well give him a written estimate of replacing the kit in it, if it could be replaced, because it would take up too much time for me to give him that estimate and then call him on telephone and say, now look, you got to have a new cylinder after you get tore apart. And I know this is happening other places where they got this bill.
Second question, do you have any knowledge of the proportion of mechanics that are paid on a commission basis versus an hourly rate?
The majority are.
Thank you. Frank Warren.
Yeah, I think there was two. John Bradshaw, I think, wanted to come up together, didn't you?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Frank Warrens. I own and operate with my father, General Automotive Repair Service in Portland. We've been in business beginning our 30th year this year. I'm here not only on my own behalf today, but as a past president of the Portland Automotive Trades Association, along with our first vice president, John Bradshaw. We are presently representing today our membership of 300 and some members at this point. I'd like to have John give you a brief background on our association.
Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, the young lady is passing out our code of ethics. I think that we, representing the Portland Automotive Trades, which we shall henceforth refer to as PATA, are just one of many associations represented here today of the automotive industry. Historically, The Oregon Automotive Trades, of interest to you, is the oldest organization of its kind dealing with the automotive industry in the world. Its inception, being in 1914, was incorporated in 1921. As Frank said, we have over 300 members, and the term Portland Automotive Trades is somewhat nebulous in that we represent a geographical area outside of even the limits of the state of Oregon. We represent a broad spectrum of people representing gas stations, through shops, through dealerships, parts stores, on up to and including warehouse distributors and manufacturers. I think, having now seen and perused the Code of Ethics, we have made a very definite attempt to apply our ethical codes. By board meeting and structure, we have the ability to either accept or deny membership through board action. We also have the ability, as has happened, to revoke membership to a member. Our past history includes the fact that in the last 5 years we have definitely attempted to communicate with the issue, the people involved with the issue of consumerism, beginning with the Tri-County situation in the metropolitan area of Portland. Mr. Dave Shannon was the first consumer protection director. From that point on, we dealt with his succeeding individuals that took his place. And more recently, Mr. Cornthwaite, representing Mr. Lee Johnson's office, was one of our speakers at our monthly dinner meeting. My points, trying to point out to you that we have made a definite attempt. You'll please excuse the rough copy. This was done in haste. One of our objections to the is the very limited time given to the Portland automotive industry to study and prepare any formal suggestions as a clarification of House Bill 2083. It's quite obvious that the repair industry had no voice in preparation, our industry, particularly in the Portland area. Their knowledge and expertise was not sought at any time, which from wording was very much needed. HB 2083 provides for an administrator, Section 23 of this act, appointed by a director who shall also appoint a board of directors consisting of 9 members who shall meet at least 6 times per year. This bill would set up an autonomy of one man who can do as he pleases without any restrictions. There are no qualifications stipulated as the director or the administrator's ability. We have listed below, and I won't belabor the point, won't take any more of your time because it is getting late, but the sections are listed that we object to, down through and up to and including section 27. Sections number 28, 29, 30, 31, and 32 we have absolutely no objection to. The board, in and of itself, structurally, we agree with. Section 12 we do disagree with. We estimate that this section is completed without reason. No one can with any certainty in most cases stay within the $50 limit imposed. Also, into this section should be introduced a fee for the shop making the estimate to be returned to the customer if that shop is awarded the repair job. The word director is used in all parts of HB 2083 is incorrectly and we portrayed, and we feel that no such power should be vested in one man. On the subject of House Bill 2084, we reject in its entirety. This bill is written, and again, we feel very strongly that whoever the sponsors are and the people writing the context of both 2083 and 2084 should feel at liberty to call on the Portland auto repair industry, in this particular instance, PAPA, for sound guidance and help. The industry would not be opposed to licensing in and of itself, and bonding in the proper manner, and will be willing to give help to the sponsors and writers of these two bills.
I might seem to have some objections because you weren't contacted personally, but in a very limited time, I might suggest to you that it's been well publicized all during the last session, the 73 session, and during the interim that we were working on these bills. And I might also suggest to you that you should be more alert to what's going on, because we don't know where everybody is in the state, and we're not going to come hold your hand. We will accept any guidance or anything else, but it's not up to us to come find you.
Mr. Chairman, I would address myself myself to that point, and we accept this responsibility, that being that we were apparently remiss in keeping our ear to the ground, as it may be, to be aware of this law. We, however, have had several meetings in our area with people in our industry. We feel that the apparent purpose of this law, proposed law 2083, is that we agree with this law in principle, but we do not feel that this law in its present form will accomplish what apparently it was intended to accomplish, and that is protection of for the consumer in the field of, or in the areas of incompetency, which we all agree is probably a greater problem than the problem of people being, as they say, ripped off by unscrupulous dealers. There are a lot of automobiles on the street today, and apparently somebody in the repair field is doing the job right, or there would be more cars in the shop than there would be on the street. We're trying to address ourselves to the problem, and that is a very small percentage point, as we heard from Mr. Wentworth earlier. We would like to try to work to improve this law, if it is necessary to have such a law, and make it more workable, not only for the repair industry, but for the consumer. I've heard the point mentioned several times today that there would be an increase in cost to the consumer for auto repairs, and the cost isn't directly related to the cost of the surety bond or the license. It would have to do with the estimate provisions of this law, and I feel sure that there are plenty of people in my business that, in order to protect themselves under this provision, that they would give a higher than usual or a higher estimate for a specific repair job than they would normally give in order to avoid having to call a customer back to tell him that there was one more thing wrong with his car. Again, I would reiterate that we are not arguing with the principle of 2083. It may be a necessary law. We would just like to have more input into this law at this time. As far as Bill 2084, I think personally, and our board of directors has discussed this, our position of 2084 is not practical at this time due to the lack of experience with testing procedures. And I think this one item alone would negate the necessity of licensing mechanics at this point. We could go over other points, but we've heard them all earlier today, and if there are any questions from the members, we would try to answer them. Representative Rogers?
You made mention of the problem with the estimate there. You feel that this bill represents the present form, that it would cause you to charge a fee for an estimate to be made?
This point of charging an estimating fee, which I don't presently do, I'm not aware if other shops do. We give estimates now on the basis that we assume that we will be given the work, or the person wouldn't be in our shop to begin with. The point that I was trying to make is that I'm not saying that I would personally, unless experience would prove that it would be necessary, but the point I'm trying to make is that it may be necessary because of the provision of this law to, in other words, instead of estimating a tune-up at $45, to estimate the tune-up at $85.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, well, Mr. Gallagher, the question is, why do you object to 2084 so much? I can't seem to see what's wrong about letting the mechanics go through a licensing process. License and most mechanics don't seem to object.
As far as Bill 2084 goes, I think that at this point, because there is a lot of disagreement on testing procedures, as far as being a licensed mechanic, this is, I have no argument with it, but there is nothing in this law, 2084, that shows that the testing procedure would be an acceptable one. The other point that I would make on that issue is that I have always, being a shop owner, felt responsible for the quality of the work that my mechanics do. And if a mechanic, and I have had them in the past, it takes me about one day watching a mechanic work to know whether he's competent or not in with the limit of responsibility that I give him.
Well, then you just answered the question. We'll get you to give a licensing test. You yourself can determine. I'm sure there's other instructors in colleges and whatnot that have built an auto mechanic for years and years that they could set up an accessible test. And this will be administered by the Department of Commerce, I believe. They'll find someone and hire someone to set up an adequate facility to test the people. And this will be paid for by the licensing fee that the mechanics will pay. So I think your statement about at this time, you know, what time we're going to start this year, we're going to start now, we're going to start 10 years from now, I think you have to take a point in time where you're going to finally start. And I think we do have adequate people to give a valid test.
The final point that I would like to make at this time is that I sincerely feel that the people in my industry, auto service repair industry, by far and away, the majority of them are very conscientious people. We want to do a good job. We want to give the consuming motorist his dollar's worth for every dollar that we spend on repairs. I personally have my customer's pocketbook, or his pocketbook, in his own best interest. I don't want to charge 10 cents more than I absolutely have to stay in business and perform the service that I enjoy doing. So I don't believe the problem is with the majority of people in this industry. I think it's a very small problem with very few individuals, and as we've heard earlier, it's primarily a communication problem between the shop owner and the customer. I think, in my own mind, there are other ways to get around this problem and correct it, rather than legislate one law after another from now ad infinitum. I think, again, to reiterate, I believe that the people in the industry, working with people like yourselves and the consumer organizations, can solve this problem without huge volumes of laws on the
Chairman, Mr. Davis, I think I can perhaps capsulize how we in the parts business feel. I'm not in the auto repair business. We're in the parts wholesale repair business. I think best summarized on the issue of whether or not 2084 is a good bill is the statement that if you were to license the individual mechanic, what guarantee does that ultimate individual that you're concerned about and that we're concerned about have that the shop owner that he's working for is equally as qualified and as just, as moral, as ethical? There's no guarantee. So why have duality? Why have overlapping laws when you can license through 2083 with some revisions as we have suggested and have been suggested today and have one set of laws rather than two, where the one 2084 by itself would do no good? The 2083 would serve the same purpose in both cases.
I see 2084 as eliminating a few, maybe let's say 5% of incompetence. Still, you know, laws never make things perfect. They only make them a little bit better. And if we can get rid of 5% of people that are incompetent, I would go with it.
Well, the only rebuttal I have to that is the fact that there's more and more people filtering out of the business ethical types. And if you have somebody that's trying to do an honest, just job, he is not going to have, as part of his contingent force, anybody that is not going to do a good job. And the drive is on towards having certified mechanics, so I think it's going to be something that is not going to have to be legislated. I quite honestly do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Rogers.
I have a comment I'd like to make, not a question to ask you. I'll ask you a question in a moment. As to this analysis you've made of some parts here, and I'd apologize for the way that the bills have to be drawn, but the director of Commerce, who's made a point of this qualification, and there's one section in here that deals with anything that is laid upon the director to do. This administrator is the guy that really is authorized to do it. I would ask you, since you represent this large a trade association, would you take this House Bill 2083 and go through it and make to this committee before we go into a work session some recommendations or changes that would make it meaningful.
We'd be only too glad to do so. And, Mr. Chairman, we have to apologize because we have, as Frank has so eloquently said, we've been remiss. We try to stay on top of things as included in the remarks in my preface. We make mistakes, but we would like nothing more than to act in concert because we all want basically the same end result. We honestly and sincerely do. And if we can do this and report back to you, all we want is a two-way communication.
We're glad if any input we can get into any legislation will come before this committee. Although I will remind everybody that these bills have been in the process for approximately 4 years or better that I know of, with many amendments. And as chairman of this committee, I am not going to hold a work session on them immediately because I can see there's problems with them. But I'm also not going to sit here and let them die in the committee. We're going to act on them one way or the other within the month. Not necessarily this month, but within a month's time from today. They are going to be up for a work session. We're going to take some action on them, but what we do with them, I don't know.
Any contributions we could make, we'd be only too glad to do so.
Just one comment. Ask you if you're aware. I think last session, the tax examiner, I believe it was licensing board administrator. True.
Yes.
And this year, when their budget came up for review, the question was asked that if this in fact had done any good, like a licensing tax preparers and these people. Of course, it was hammered some. Are you aware that those people that were in the business and as a sideline, and some of those that maybe were border cases as to qualifications and things like that, did not ask to be licensed and dropped by the wayside? And so, in effect, the process maybe tended to weed out those that were not qualified, or of course it could have tended to weed out some of those that were maybe qualified and just chose not to because of it was a sideline and maybe didn't add income to them. But I'm asking if you were aware of this.
I wasn't aware of the particulars. I don't know if Frank was or not, but this is what commonly in our industry is referred to as the curb stoner or the shade treater. You're not going to ever eliminate totally the do-it-yourselfer, which is a large impact upon the market, particularly now with the economy being what it is, nor are you going to eliminate the ethical, profitable shop. But this bill and this sort of tax situation will eliminate what I think has been, as far as safety concerned, as far as actual capabilities, the biggest area of concern, these fellows that call themselves so-called mechanic or wrenches in our industry and have done more disservice to our industry than a lot of the reputable shops.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
If you want to go, I know what you have to do, and we're going to have to adjourn this no later than 4:30 anyway. And so, Tom and Ed and Otto, we will make sure that we hear you later because you're always here anyway. Joe Bernard.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would like to say that I'm an independent shop operator in Milwaukee. We have a shop on the same corner in Milwaukee, started in May 1926, will be 50 years old this year. My father started it, and we've been there for a long time, and we feel that we have a good business, and a business that I enjoy. I would like to point out, it seems like repairing cars is just about as popular these days as making legislation. It's not necessarily win you a lot of friends and influence people, but it's one of the practicalities of life. It's been pointed out earlier, and I will cut my remarks short, the The repair shops are under all kinds of regulations that demand that we do honest and ethical repair. The Consumers Protection Bureau, the District Attorney, the Attorney General's Office, the Small Claims Court, and any courts of the land are some of the controls placed on the independent repair shop operator. And I, in our county, have helped the District Attorney on two or three cases that he has had question on. We had a speaker from the Attorney General's Office who said, claimed that he was the Chief Prosecutor for the Attorney General's Office in the state of Oregon for consumer complaints, and he said that they had an average of about 80 automotive consumer complaints a month, and when they boiled that all down, they had about 20 legitimate questionable consumer complaints and probably 5 to 6% of actual fraud cases that they had experienced in the past. So, as we all know, the cost of operation is going up, and I would like to present just a short case to you because I thought of this the other day when I had a customer approach my place of business and ask me. He said he had a scraping noise in the brakes of his car and that his heater didn't work. Would I give him an estimate on the cost of those repairs? Well, I could tell you this, that the brake job, without taking the car apart and disassembling, could run between $90 and $200, depending upon what was wrong with it. The heater repair could have run from $1 to $70, in the quickest estimate that I could give. So no way would I possibly give that man an estimate on that job unless he signed a waiver and then allowed me to take whatever steps necessary to repair the car, unless I brought that car in the shop, disassembled it, and found out whether the fuse was blown in the heater motor or the heater motor was frozen up, or if anyone in the automotive business might know, maybe some of the automatic controls were not working, which could consume several days' work. So I would certainly say that the big cost of the consumer is going to be in the cost of giving him a definite estimate. And I, for one, the question was asked today, would you be willing to give a guy an oral estimate over the telephone or some other method? And I, for one, if this was law, would back away from that with a 10-foot pole, because the thing that you convey to the consumer and that the consumer receives in his computer and gives back to you that night when he comes to pay the bill might be altogether different. And how am I going to prove that the customer said, go ahead? Or the husband will call and say, my wife had no authority to do that, or my son had no authority to have that job done. And so therefore, who are you going to blame? You said you have an oral agreement, but who would it be with? The registered owner of the car, the legal owner of the car, or the driver of the car? I don't know how you could determine this unless you had a title search made on every vehicle and it was spelled out who had to give the permission. It seems like that really what amounts to, and I would like to bring out one point. You asked a question about the certification test. And one of the things, before you can receive a certificate, you have to be experienced in the trade for 4 years. So it's not a matter of sitting down, writing out, answering questions, and not having the ability to do some work. You have to have at least 4 years' experience in the trade. I feel that this bill does nothing at all to upgrade the industry. And I think if I get the rumor right, the one to license the TV repair people has not had the impact of upgrading the people in the industry or satisfying the consumer. Therefore, I feel that we are doing nothing but developing another Bureau of Government who will increase the price to the consumer, and if my reading of last night's journal is anything correct, the greatest thing we have in the, as far as inflation and the cost of living is government, and I think that is one thing we do not need is more government. We would not be in business for 50 years on the corner that we are if we had cheated or defrauded customers. And unfortunately, there are some, and I will readily agree with that. Thank God that I cut it short. Any questions?
I might mention, because he's pretty emphatic, he's an ex-mayor of the city of Milwaukee. I'm not going to hold it. Against the fact that the Republican always supports my opponent.
We're in the same district, and I worked on Glenn Scar and his boys, too.
Any questions, Joe? Guess not. I guess
no questions?
I guess you're scared.
I've got it. I'd like to answer a couple.
I'm still trying to absorb everything.
Well, you shouldn't call the meeting off at 4:30.
Not through choice, but
there must have been a politician in there somewhere.
Okay? Thank you.
Bill Beatty?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I think most everything's been said, so I'll cut mine down short, but in about 16 years here, we've been talking in this state about some kind of licensing for garages and mechanics. I think with the public feelings where a lot of it's justified, a lot of it isn't justified, I think it's time we done something to appease this. We as mechanics in the shop really can't take the verbal abuse sometimes that we get. Still feel like doing the customer's job or hoping that he comes back so our company can keep going. I would like to, at this time, be in support of both bills. I don't think it hurts any of us to be licensed, and I think certainly it's going to upgrade us. I think if a man's got a license in his pocket, he's going to do something to protect it the same as he is in his billfold that's in that pocket. And I think this will give the customer a lot better chance to talk to that mechanic to get the work done that he wants done and to get some corrections if there is some misunderstanding or mistake on either one of them's part at that time. I heard here today that we didn't have people qualified to come in the trade. That is true. We certainly don't, but I think we have the means for training them. I've served on the apprenticeship committee and I served on the penitentiary and OCI committee. I can assure you, I believe that there's plenty of means for training beginners, and there's means at community colleges for upgrading the mechanic that's on the job now. In other words, if he worked a few years at one thing, especially, and in order to keep his job, he needs to slip over into refrigeration or something. There's no reason why he can't be upgraded and get that part of it and get going on down the line with what he wants to do.
You are a mechanic, you say?
I have been a mechanic for a number of years. I'm an automotive vocational instructor out in McLaren School right at this time.
Any questions?
Yeah. I asked an earlier question. I got any ideas on it would be kind of helpful. I think it's probably, say a person is an expert when it comes to Mazda Wankel engines. But outside of that, he doesn't know too much about how, you know, a normal one works, let's say. How do you think the best way to resolve, say, that kind of a problem where you have these real specialized fields?
Mr. Wolfer, what it's going to have to be is a card that specifies, a license that specifies what this man can do. Now, there's no question that six of us can be in a shop and one of us is a whiz at an automatic transmission. And I work beside the kind of people that could beat me all the holler. But you come in with a taillight short, which was pretty simple to find, and that guy, he'd go have coffee, anything to get out of that stall and get away from there, so he didn't get that wiring job because he didn't like them, so consequently he wasn't proficient at it. So I think you're going to have one mechanic, if he wants to work on a Wankel engine, fine, he gets a license for that. Now, if he wants to work on fuel injection, he'll have this covered in his license or go over and get it if he wants to transfer over this way. Is that answering what you're asking?
Yes. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
George Warren.
Mr. Chairman, I am prepared to testify that because of the time, I would prefer, because I live in Salem, work at state, that you could call me back so we can have another hearing.
We will. Well, we're going to have to, before we go into work sessions, we're going to have to do some things. We have three of the pros around here that aren't going to get heard today, so they'll have to
Whether or not, after all the expert testimony, I do have something to contribute, so I would like to postpone it.
All righty.
Thank you.
We'll just, in case like that, we'll close this hearing and we'll adjourn the meeting.